Monday, June 24th, 2013. You're listening to the Jack Blood Show. I am Jack Blood, your narrator, your radio gun, reporting for the next 2 hours. We're here Monday through Friday, 10 o'clock a.m. to 12 o'clock noon Eastern Time, and repeating throughout the day. Thank you, everybody, for picking us up and for checking us out and for tuning us in. Welcome, my fellow thought criminals, enemies of the state, and Gitmo Nation, feral humans, wherever you are. We have one feral human with us this morning. Been a while since he's been on the broadcast. He's been busy procreating. Well, I mean, he did that 10 months ago. We know he can do it. We know his bullets fire straight. We'll get to all the news in the second hour of the show, but a lot of the breaking news we'll talk about now with our guest, James Corbett. He is the publisher and editor of The Corbett Report, the great podcast and news service that goes out, thecorbettreport.com from Japan. He joins us on the broadcast this morning. James, great to have you.
Great to be here, I think. But what did you call me? Feral human?
Yes.
I've been called worse, I guess.
It's an honor, isn't it?
It is, actually. It really is, especially as we plunge into the transhumanist nightmare. I'm happy and proud to be a flesh and blood human being who may be frail and may fall apart and will probably expire from this mortal coil one day, but I'm still proud to be alive and here and kicking and making my presence felt on this planet while I'm here. So I am a proud feral human.
That's right, and so are my listeners. You're wild, you cannot be trained, you cannot be domesticated, and that's the funny thing about my friend James Corbett. He doesn't look like any of that, but he is, 100%, and your bullet shoots straight. So congratulations on the new addition to the Corbett household. I know you've been busy doing that, so it's great to have you back.
Well, it's great to be here. Thank you so much. Absolutely life-changing experience. Couldn't have asked for a better experience. And my wife and child are doing fine, so I am raring to go and kick some New World Order butt.
There you go. Okay, well, hey, let's hit some news then this morning. It's Monday, and my listeners are usually chomping at the bit, as am I, to talk about some of the new developments over the weekend. News doesn't really happen here on the weekend. James, you've lived in this country before. It's sports, it's entertainment, it is health segments, and then you get the Sunday news shows that really try to set the stage for the coming week. As we know, they write the notes, they try to control the news cycle. That's what our Sunday news shows do here. But other than that, we don't hear much going on over the weekend. It's almost like the news just kind of stops over the weekend. That's why they like to do things on a Friday. It gets them out of trouble. They don't have to deal with the news. But we did see on one of the Sunday news shows, Dick Gregory getting ripped by Glenn Greenwald for wondering aloud if maybe journalists should be charged with felonies and aiding and abetting whistleblowers. You work a lot with Sybil Edmonds, and we've all worked with a lot of whistleblowers. That's pretty dangerous ground for the host of Meet the Press to go on. Uh-huh. Let's talk about that, and let's talk about this Edward Snowden case from your perspective.
Well, absolutely. That insinuation that journalists should be threatened with legal action for aiding and abetting people like Snowden is absolutely despicable, especially coming from someone who claims to be a journalist. But we all know better. We know what he is. You're exactly right. He's a shill. He is just standing in for the puppet masters in power. And when confronted about that really reprehensible statement, he came back immediately to say, well, I'm just putting out there a question that other people have. But we all know exactly what's behind that. And especially in these times of the NDAA. I mean, how absolutely despicable is this that now we're absolutely out in the open attempting to demonize anyone who's trying to bring information to the American public that the administration deems too threatening for the people to know about, the little peons. So absolutely a disgusting display, as is all of the manhunt that's going on around now about the Snowden drama. And it is absolutely fascinating to be watching this drama unfolding in real time and people on the websites tracking the plane that as it was going from Hong Kong to Moscow and everything, and all of the hype and drama surrounding this. But in a weird, sick way, I think that the manhunt that's surrounding Snowden right now actually plays into the U.S. government's agenda in all of this for a couple of reasons. And first and foremost, I think it's because at the end of the day, what message does this send to future would-be whistleblowers in the national security establishment except, hey, look what's going to happen to you if you ever even think about attempting to blow the whistle on what's going on. If you don't do it through our pre-approved, government-approved whistleblower channels, which will go nowhere and do nothing, then you are going to be hunted down like a dog wherever you are. And that's a pretty sick state of affairs, but it unfortunately, it's kind of what this whole drama is starting to play into now.
Does that fall into the category of never let a good crisis go to waste? So here we have the alleged whistleblower, NSA whistleblower Edward Snowden, and the Obama administration is saying, well, okay, that sucks, but let's turn this into a positive and brand him with espionage and hunt him around the world to scare the other potential whistleblowers. I mean, before you start taking documents now, you're going to look at Edward Snowden and go, wow, do I really want that for my life? So is it just them taking advantage of this situation, as they always say, never let a good crisis go to waste? Or is there something about this? Are we getting snowed, I think is how we put it last week. Do we completely trust this very kind of scripted and egotistical whistleblower?
It's a good question, and it's one that we have to ask, unfortunately, in this day and age, because, I mean, we saw what WikiLeaks was all about and Julian Assange and all the drama there, and, you know, people can make up their minds as they will about that. I tend to think of WikiLeaks as, at best, a limited hangout operation, if not actually a completely controlled operation. But again, with Snowden and people like this stepping forward, I mean, there's always the question lingering. Is this some sort of limited hangout? Is this a case where perhaps he is a genuine whistleblower, but he's been leaked certain controlled documents that spin the thing in a certain way? Or is he a genuine whistleblower with genuine documents that's genuinely trying to get this out? Either in any of those eventualities, as you say, this plays into their, you know, never let a good crisis go to waste mentality, and it is playing out in their overall agenda, so I guess it doesn't matter that way. And in another way, I mean, I think this entire Snowden drama is to a large extent irrelevant. There isn't a lot in the Snowden documents that's coming out, other than a couple of specific parts, but there isn't a lot that we didn't already know, and in fact, didn't know even in more detail before. From people like Mark Klein, the AT&T whistleblower, who for some reason no one ever talks about anymore, but back in 2006 he revealed that room 641A in the San Francisco facility of AT&T that was splitting off the internet trunk that was coming in from overseas into the San Francisco data facility, splitting it right there, and one room that the wire would go into was owned and operated by the NSA, and he revealed the documents showing exactly the type of information systems they had, including Naris systems, which is an Israeli-owned company, interestingly enough, that is specifically designed to store massive amounts of data. So we've known for at least the last 7 or 8 years now that the NSA has been in bed with the telecom agencies and scooping up all of the data flowing into the country wholesale, not just the metadata, but the content of that data as well. We've gotten that from other whistleblowers as well. We've heard from Russ Tice and Thomas Drake and J. Kirk Wybie. And all of these whistleblowers are now being kind of shunned and marginalized because there's this Snowden guy who comes out of nowhere, this 29-year-old Booz Allen Hamilton subcontractor employee with all of the PRISM documents and things. But again, I think we've gotten much more of this story. And here's the thing. Here's the big thing that I want to break on your show today, because as far as I know, there isn't a single American broadcast media outlet that has covered this yet. But last week, NSA whistleblower Russ Tice, who was one of the sources for the 2005 New York Times Eric Lichtblau, James Risen article that broke the NSA warrantless wiretapping story, he came out with even more details and named names about some of the targets of previous NSA wiretapping, that he himself held the documents for the wiretap orders in his hands, including people like high-ranking military officials like General David Petraeus, including Supreme Court justices. He said every single one of the Supreme Court justices was specifically targeted for wiretapping by the NSA, and he physically held the order for wiretapping Alito in his hand. High-ranking congressional and Republican and Democratic congressional leaders, White House Press Secretary Scott McClelland, and even a little-known Illinois senator who went on to become President of the United States, Barack Obama, was specifically being wiretapped by the NSA back in 2004. They have the goods on all of these politicians. They are in the back pocket. These people are being blackmailed. This is the massive story that's being covered up by this constant attention on Snowden and his documents.
That just raises so many questions. I have a story at deadlinelive.info, NSA surveillance of politicians, be compliant or be exposed. And we think about David Petraeus, who had, I thought, had some shadowy dealings in that Benghazi affair along with Hillary Clinton. They kind of were the most who stood to gain from something like that. Maybe potentially the Bushes and the Romneys, as Jeb Bush certainly is running up the ladder here to run for 2016. And I thought Petraeus might have been involved in that. He was thinking about running for president himself, either as a stalking horse or a vice presidential possibility for Jeb Bush. But he wasn't compliant. He didn't go along with everything. And if they caught his hands in the cookie jar in that deal, then they let it go. They let it out. And interestingly enough, one of the people that was possibly and potentially involved in that story was Michael Hastings, the reporter who died in the fiery bomb crash in Los Angeles here last week. I want to get to that in a little bit. But let's stay on course, because you brought up something that made me think. That's why I love having you on the show.
I hope so. Let me just interrupt you
Russ
for a second.
Tice, hold on. Russ Tice comes out with this bombshell, and we're talking about, again, they're surveilling all the politicians. They want to make sure everybody's in check. They want to make sure that everybody isn't, you know, no one's planning to stab them in the back. All of this, I think, has to do with punishing your political enemies and keeping the establishment in check. Could this whole Snowden snow up be a cover to suck up all the oxygen in the media environment so that nobody does report on what Russ Tice is reporting and what you just broke on my show?
Well, here's the thing. I mean, I am very interested in the timing of this Snowden thing, because it's coming exactly as you remember a few weeks ago, the big story was the AP spying story. That was a month or two ago now. A lot of people starting to talk about that. Oh, look, they're listening in on journalists' communications. Oh, this is now a big story. And all of a sudden, Snowden comes on the scene, and the IRS scandal, the Benghazi scandal, the AP spying scandal, all of that's gone. All of the focus is on Snowden right now. So it is interesting timing, but I did specifically bring that up with my interview with Russ Tice last week on CorbettReport.com, and asked him what his opinion on it was. He said, well, we know that Snowden's been working with Guardian and Washington Post behind the scenes for a few months before this, so the timing may be coincidental. Either way, however it plays out, it does take the focus off of some of the other scandals, and it is right now at this point burying the Russ Tice revelations. Again, he was on BoilingFrogsPost.com and on my website, CorbettReport.com, breaking this. It did get some write-ups on Huffington Post, on The Blaze, on AOL, on Drudge Report, so it has gotten out there a little bit, but it hasn't been covered by any broadcast media that I know of. And in fact, Russ Tice, in the wake of this Snowden scandal, was offered four different on-camera interviews by different news outlets in the U.S. All four of them canceled before his time to go on. After the breaking of this new revelations about the wiretapping of Congress and the president and all of this, MSNBC scheduled him to have him on. He gets in the town car, he gets over there, he gets to the studio, he puts the earphone in and gets the lighting and hair and whatever else set up and ready to go for the interview. 5 minutes before air, they tell him, oh, by the way, we've talked to our lawyers, you can't mention the wiretapping. So the entire point of the entire interview ends up becoming null and void. He has to sort of stammer his way through an interview saying, well, I'd like to tell the American people what I know, but I can't. And that was basically the extent of what MSNBC covered. So this is being covered up right now. And there are, I think, powerful forces that are trying to keep this story suppressed. So it is up to the people out there to get the word out about this. I'm working on a little video that I'm going to be posting on my YouTube page today, just with some of the highlights from our conversation, just showing some of this. And I hope people will get that out and spread it to the four winds, because we are going to have to break this through to the mainstream, I think.
Well, great minds think for themselves, but sometimes alike, because it's the first thing I came to when I heard about all of this Snowden stuff here is that, wow, there go all those other scandals. I mean, that's just gone now. It's, you know, between that and Syria and whatever else new is happening, that's how they keep you distracted. And that's how they continue to, you know, elevate the rabbit hole, so to speak. So I think there is something to that. I don't know if Snowden is a willing dupe or a dupe. in general, but the more I'm hearing you talk, the more it sounds like something is horribly wrong here. You know, we always think of the media. This is what we always hear, James. If anything happened at 9/11 that the government wasn't telling the truth about, wouldn't the media be reporting it? Wouldn't whistleblowers be blowing the whistle? Well, of course, they have blown the whistle, as you know, with Sybil Edmonds and Mary Schneider and Willie Rodriguez. There's so many of them out there.
Richard Grove, Barry Jennings. Right.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Some of them aren't with us anymore, exactly. as you might be alluding to. So, I mean, the fact that Russ Tice is there and this is a big story and media should be adding to the story. They should look at a juicy exclusive that could come from somebody like Russ Tice and interject that into the conversation to make themselves at least look like they're doing their job. But the fact that they won't do that and that they will cover it up shows that, well, maybe their phones are tapped and they've been compromised. Well, they are tapped and they probably have been compromised. This is how they keep control of everything. That is the larger story.
That's it. And it is an overarching system of control, but it does have its pressure points and its weaknesses, because when there's a big scandal like this that's trending, everyone's talking about it, all the attention's on Snowden, you have things like the hashtag NSA is trending on Twitter every day now. So there are ways for people to use the momentum that's behind this story to get out the real story about the real NSA spying scandal. It's not about metadata. It's not about the PRISM program that's this little $20 million a year program. It's about the wholesale collection of all communications and the specific targeting of high-ranking government and military officials for wiretapping that's been going on for, at least a decade now, according to what Russ Tice said. So this is huge, and I think there are pressure points that we can use the momentum that's around this story to get it out, but it is going to be up to the people out there, because obviously the mainstream outlets and even people like Glenn Greenwald has not even acknowledged Russ Tice's comments yet. So
why is that? If he is a legitimate journalist, and I've always liked how when Obama came in, he kept the pressure on, that he's had pretty good fights with Lawrence O'Donnell. He got Lawrence O'Donnell from MSNBC to admit, "I'm a socialist. I want to take your guns," trying to out progressive Glenn Greenwald once at a round table. It just came right out of his mouth. I thought that was pretty telling. I've seen him go after any number of these so-called progressive pundits and lay waste to them. So maybe he was just building his credibility, so to speak. But he looks for all the world to me to be like a legitimate journalist. Is he playing a role in this? If he's refusing Russ Tice information or other information that are leading to even a bigger scandal and a wider scandal, you know, why would he do that?
Well, let me be clear about this. I am a huge fan of Glenn Greenwald's work that he's done on so many different issues. He has done some incredible work. He is always very thorough and very persuasive in his argumentation. He always has his I's dotted and his T's crossed when he files a report. So I do read his work and I do follow it. But I have noticed over the years there are certain areas that he will not stray into. And I'm not just talking about the big ones like 9/11 truth or things like that. I'm talking about even some of the very things that he supposedly covers. For example, he's talked about the state secrets privilege and how that's been invoked to try to squash national security cases and things in the past. And yet there are certain state secret privilege cases that he will never mention. For example, Sybil Edmonds. He will not cover Sybil Edmonds directly, and a little bit of behind the scenes scuttlebutt. Now that he's with The Guardian, there was the attempt to bring a recent story about Sybil Edmonds to The Guardian that was quashed from what I've heard because of the influence of a certain American writer who is now on their staff. So there are certain areas that he will not go into, and in fact he will specifically avoid.
That makes him a gatekeeper. He's at least a gatekeeper. Now, I'm not trying to throw mud here because I happen to like his reporting too, and I think there's definitely a place in the world for the Glenn Greenwalds, and a lot of the other repeaters, not reporters, could take notes from a guy like that. But you get put in this position that if you don't gatekeep, if you don't do a little bit of that, your career isn't going to go well, and you could find yourself in a big scandal and a lot of trouble. And a lot of these guys are just frankly very scared of that. I want to go, and Michael Isikoff I thought was a pretty good example. I was thinking about him as you were talking about Glenn Greenwald, the pretty big reporter and pundit, came on this show once and I called him right out. He didn't like it. But I thought he was gatekeeping information, and I felt that the reason he did it was to go along to get along. This is really the mentality of corporate media. You know that if you don't do it, they don't actually tell you. I've been inside the Fox super circle, and they don't tell you, you got to report this and let's spin this and let's put out propaganda. They just kind of send you little notes about what they'd like to see you report. If you don't report that, they don't have any use for you. So you don't want to let in people like Sybil Edmonds and rock the boat when you're told not to. You know, I also am thinking about Jane Harmon, who was targeted in the Bush administration, and the NSA wiretapped her. And what did we find out? That she was covering up. She was involved in Israeli espionage. And so they had her by the short ones. And the next thing you know, she's supporting wiretapping and all the rest of Americans and everything else Alberto Gonzalez and the Bush administration wanted to do, including the Homegrown Terrorist Act, where she held up architects and engineers for 9/11 Truth as being an example of somebody that could inspire terrorism. So here's somebody that was caught again and really doing what most the establishment would do, helping and aiding the Zionists in Israel. She was doing that. But that was a way to blackmail her to go along with, because she was also opposing warrantless wiretapping. Now she's not, and she's the first one to criticize and put labels on Edward Snowden.
Well, I mean, you're right about everything you've said there. I have absolutely no idea about the motives of the people here. All I know is what I can actually see them doing. And when they will not cover certain things, or when they do 180-degree turns on things that they've advocated in the past, there's clearly something going on in the background. And at the end of the day, it doesn't even necessarily matter what that is. We just have to know that, yep, there are gatekeepers that are placed in certain places, or that are raised up on the understanding, the wink and the nod, that they will not go into certain areas. And there are people who are put into positions of power, like in Congress or the judiciary or high-ranking military officials, who are put into those positions specifically because there is dirt on them. And I actually just recorded a conversation just earlier today, my time here in Japan, yesterday for you guys, with Sybil Edmonds about this. That's now up on my website at Corbett Report, where we talk about some of the things that she saw in her time with the FBI, about the FBI collecting dirt on various politicians to blackmail. So this is obviously, I mean, this is not surprising to people who've been following this, but it's unfortunately part of the sad reality we're dealing with all of this, that you can't trust the officials to come in and adjudicate over this. You can't trust the judiciary to keep this in check. You can't trust the executive branch to faithfully execute orders. You can't trust the system that's been placed there, because everyone at the top of that system is at the top because there is dirt on them and because they're being controlled.
Well, except for potentially Ron Paul and Dennis Kucinich, who are no longer in government. So
exactly. You get run out if there's anything that, you know.
Well, they didn't care because they were just crazy Dennis and crazy Ron. But when they started getting traction with the American people, who literally have about a 10% approval rating of government over here, no matter what party they're in, by the way, that's when they start threatening them and chopping their heads off and giving them offers that they can't refuse. I remember, you know, close call plane crashes and some other things involved with those potential leaders, those congressmen. What about the hubris involved in setting this whole thing up, doing a purposeful leak, which I believe WikiLeaks does serve that purpose? They're up to their eyeballs now, apparently, in this Edward Snowden whistleblowing case. What about the hubris that you went too far, that you woke up the sleeping beast, that is the American people? Sorry, American people, I didn't mean to call you that. The wonderful we the peeps out there maybe finally got this through their heads, that this is not a good idea, that the conversations are going on at the water coolers and at the family dinner table, that this extensive high-tech spying that people like you and I have warned people about for the last decade is actually true. It takes over every little piece of your life. You have nothing private anymore, which I guess is supposed to be a good thing. And what about the hubris of them maybe going too far and exciting and lighting the fires of liberty in doing so?
I think you're exactly right. I mean, it is a dangerous game that they play every time they want to move the ball a little bit further down the field, because they have to put the ball in motion. And when that happens, there's always the chance for a fumble. There's always a chance for something to happen that can be picked up on by the other team. And this is exactly what's happening right now. We're right in the middle of a major story that's moving, is a moving target. And they have all of the pieces out there on the field. They've got all of the pieces of this puzzle. And now they're turning it towards this manhunt for Snowden. Snowden and making that into the big spectacle that's playing out. But again, we can use that momentum against them. And if we can just pick up that ball and run it back into their end zone, then we've made a major score, a victory out of what looks like defeat. And that can happen. It has happened before. And that's something that I really want to stress to the audience out there. I see this happening right now. There are people who are waking up to the political left-right farce that have been safely asleep for their entire lives. And I'm seeing this happening online in a lot of different places, both among the sort of the big, progressive media, alternative media or internet media celebrities, quote unquote celebrities, also just regular people. Like if you go to reddit.com, which has just been, a cesspool of Obama hope and change Kool-Aid drinkers, is now starting to finally realize, oh, wait, he wasn't what he said. There is a chance that we can actually use this to start informing people of what's really going on. So I don't want people to just hear what's going on and cower in fear. I think that's giving into what they want. I think this is actually a great opportunity for us.
Well, keeping in mind, the founder and creator of Reddit was murdered himself, we believe, Aaron Schwartz, not too long ago. And for whatever they did, they were picking up some of my stuff, and I bet they're picking up some of your stuff, too. So that has been rather convenient to have a big site like that helping us get our news out, which we wouldn't have had, 6, 7, 8 years ago. James Corbett is with us, thecorbettreport.com, or not the, just corbettreport.com, and interview 687 with whistleblower, 9/11 whistleblower Sybil Edmonds, blowing the whistle on government blackmailing. Going back to hubris, I often say, James, that if it hadn't been for 9/11, I might have just been going my merry way. I think that really was the cataclysm for me, the tipping point after the stolen election and everything else that really got me off my butt to dedicate so much of my time to preserving liberty and exposing the evildoers. And so that, I think, again, talking about hubris, overconfidence, going too far, pushing us a little too far, I think that, in a sense, did backfire. But look at all the goals they accomplished. We wouldn't even be talking about the NSA and all of this had it not been for 9/11, which is why we continue to talk about it and try to expose it. All right, James, how about this for a little factoid? Obama has charged more under Espionage Act than all other presidents combined. In fact, twice as much than all the other presidents combined. And what about that for transparency and hope and change?
Yes, the Nobel Peace Prize laureate, the constitutional scholar Obama, who, by the way, was also awarded a prize for transparency about a year after taking office by some of the big name corporate lapdog funded, foundation funded transparency groups there in Washington. They gave him a transparency award for being a transparent government. And I know that they're kicking themselves over that, or at least the optics of that. But the best part about that was the award that they gave him, the Sunshine Transparency Award that they gave him for being the most transparent president in history, was given in a closed-door meeting that was the press wasn't invited to. They weren't allowed in to actually record what was happening. So there you go. This is exactly what this administration is about. It's 180 degrees on everything that was promised. And finally, people are waking up to it, but slowly but surely.
Well, I got to tell you, he takes a hit, but he doesn't have to run again, and it's already set up. In fact, I think this whole thing is juiced. This could even be part of the cost-benefit analysis in wearing people out on the hope and the changers and in the Democrat Party in general so that Jeb Bush can rise like a phoenix. How else are they going to put another Bush in office, James? You thought the second one was impossible. Maybe people thought the first one was impossible. People now would have to believe the third Bush as a president is completely impossible. But not after they get done wearing you out with hope and change and transparency and peace, right?
Oh, yes. Well, it's either Bush or maybe Clinton. I mean, take your pick.
No, she's too much involved. That's why they tried to Benghazi, I think, Cousin Barry Obama. She wanted him to lose because then you'd have had Romney for 4 years and it would have been anybody but a Republican. Nah, I think she's acting as the Henry Kissinger stalking horse in all of this. But we can debate that when we come back. James Corbett is with us, CorbettReport.com. I want to come back, James, after this break and talk about the revolutions spawning up, whether it be Turkey or Brazil. I think maybe we could look at and say the American Spring has started here, whether by hook or crook. so we can talk about that. We can clean up a little bit about this Snowden case. We might have one or two more things to talk about. And then Michael Hastings, we've got some new information on him. What was he saying hours before his death, journalist Michael Hastings, before his brand new Mercedes blew the F up right in public in Hollywood, the land of illusions? We'll tell you that when we come back. Stay with us. Here's the little clip of David Gregory getting ripped by Glenn Greenwald. This is what's at stake here. Journalists being able to do their job. We'll be right back. More on the Jack Blood Show with our friend James Corbett right after this.
Final question before for you, but I'd like you to hang around. I just want to get Pete Williams in here as well. To the extent that you have aided and abetted Snowden, even in his current movements, why shouldn't you, Mr. Greenwald, be charged with a crime?
I think it's pretty extraordinary that anybody who would call themselves a journalist would publicly muse about whether or not other journalists should be charged with felonies. The assumption in your question, David, is completely without evidence, the idea that I've aided and abetted him in any way. The scandal that arose in Washington before our stories began was about the fact that the Obama administration is trying to criminalize investigative journalism by going through the emails and phone records of AP reporters, accusing a Fox News journalist of the theory that you just embraced, being a co-conspirator with felonies for working with sources. If you want to embrace that theory, it means that every investigative journalist in the United States who works with their sources, who receives classified information, is a criminal. And it's precisely those theories and precisely that climate that has become so menacing in the United States. It's why the New Yorker's Jane Mayer said investigative reporting has come to a standstill, her word, as a result of the theories that you just referenced.
Journalist Michael Hastings. The FBI said today that Hastings was never under investigation, despite the journalist's apparent concerns that he was the target of a federal probe. The 33-year-old was killed in a fiery one-vehicle car crash early Tuesday morning in Hancock Park. Hastings is best known for a 2010 magazine article that led to the resignation of General Stanley McChrystal, who was the former U.S. and NATO forces commander in Afghanistan. Our Carolyn Costello received an exclusive email Hastings sent just hours before his tragic death.
I thought he was a great person. I mean, he spoke the truth. I mean, he said what needed to be said. He said what a lot of people were scared to say. You know, and it does offend a lot of people, but the truth hurts.
Staff Sergeant Joseph Biggs knew Michael Hastings well. Hastings was embedded with Biggs' unit in Afghanistan back in 2008. He tells us the two have kept in touch over the years. It had been several months since they last spoke when Biggs got an email from Hastings that didn't seem quite right.
Monday morning, I woke up and I get an email and it's very panicked.
Biggs says he was blind copied on the email sent to Hastings' colleagues. It reads, "Hey, the feds are interviewing my, quote, close friends and associates. Perhaps if the authorities arrive at BuzzFeed GQ or HQ, may be wise to immediately request legal counsel before any conversations or interviews about our news gathering practices or related journalism issues. Also, I'm on to a big story and need to go off the radar for a bit."
It alarmed me very much. I wrote a few things. I told a few people about it. I just said it doesn't seem like him. In a sense, I just had this gut feeling, and it just really bothered me.
The email was sent just before 1 Monday afternoon. 15 hours later, Hastings was killed in this fiery crash on Highland Avenue. Strangers showed up to the scene to pay their respects.
I'm hoping nobody was following him, and he just lost control.
Breaking news photographer Scott Lane happened to be less than a mile from the scene of the crash Tuesday morning and shot this video. Video from his car's dash camera caught what appears to be Hastings' Mercedes minutes before the crash, speeding through a red light. 34 seconds pass, and no other cars pass through the intersection.
There's no cars that are following him. And he flies by. 10 seconds, 20 seconds, 30 seconds goes by. No cars are following him.
While conspiracy theories circulate on the internet about what might have led to this fiery crash, Staff Sergeant Biggs tells us he just hopes to learn the truth about the events leading up to his friend's
death. Yeah, just accept what they tell you. He was driving late in the morning, probably drunk, and as people had embedded earlier, just not a month before his death or less, that he was a little bit crazy. You know, crazy investigative reporters. You got to be a little crazy to be an investigative reporter. And no, but here's a guy that's actually working on Michael Hastings, the reporter, working on a big story, tells people, "Hey, I got a big story here. I've got to go off the radar for a while," which would allude to the first half hour we did with our guest today, James Corbett. He knows he better go off the radar because he is being monitored, because he's not a gatekeeper, because he is not somebody that can be shut up in silence, because he just loves a good story and he's going to get to the bottom of it, whether there's a conspiracy there or not. So here's somebody, James, that they couldn't control. Here's somebody that they couldn't threaten. Here's somebody they couldn't buy off or pressure or whatever. And he's dead now. And I think this story stinks, whether I'm saying it's a conspiracy theory or we're not being told the truth. In fact, they haven't told us anything much, so we don't really even know what the truth is at this point. We're doing our job as reporters, believe it or not. James Corbett with us on the broadcast today. Does that pique your interest at all, that little clip?
It resonates with me a lot, and people who have been listening to my podcast might know that I have this recurring series, Requiem for the Suicided, where we've talked about all sorts of people, like, of course, Gary Webb and David Kelly, and we've talked about the DC Madam, we've talked about Danny Casolaro, over and over and over, and that report just resonates so much with every single one of those cases that I've covered in the past, because it's just time and time and time again. It's someone working on a big story, they tell someone they've got some important documents, they're about to release a new book, whatever the case may be, they're on the brink of something, and lo and behold, they end up dead, and usually under mysterious suicide circumstances, like shooting themselves twice in the head, like Gary Webb, or things like that. But it just happens so often that even I would imagine the most skeptical out there would have to admit that it's a little bit stretching the bonds of credulity to imagine that all of these are just coincidences. But again, apparently for people who are not willing to immediately come to the conclusion assumption that there was nothing untoward about this. Apparently, we're the crazy ones. So, No, take that for what it's worth, which is absolutely nothing.
Well, because brand new Mercedes just catch fire and blow up all the time. And when they do that, the engine flies 100 feet away from the car itself. I mean, this is, I mentioned to my listeners last week, James, this is like a Building 7, where it's never happened before, it will never happen again. It was just a one-time thing. And that's why people buy $60,000, $70,000 brand-new Mercedes, because of their safety.
Exactly right. No, let's put this in perspective for people. I mean, let's really talk about this a little, because it's so important to look at some of the parallels with this and some other cases that have happened before. Because I was listening to your show last week, and you said there was a listener who had written in to say, oh, he's not even in the ground and we're already making up conspiracy theories. Why are we doing this? Why are we wasting time on this? That is just absolute ignorance of the incredible list of people who have died under these types of mysterious circumstances before. So, I mean, we have people like Gary Webb, who people might know. He broke the CIA drug running back in the Iran-Contra that fed into the crack cocaine epidemic. His reporting was smeared at the time. He lost his job, etc., etc., but it's all been vindicated since then. And now the people who were smearing him at the time have come back to say they apologize for having done that posthumously, because he apparently shot himself twice in the head while working on a new book about the CIA. We have Danny Casolaro, who was breaking the story about the octopus, which fed into the Promise software that became P-TECH that was used on 9/11, and all of this craziness in the Reagan DOJ. He was finishing up a book. He goes to a hotel to in Virginia to work on the last couple of crossing the T's and dotting the I's with his manuscript. He ends up committing suicide by slicing himself to pieces in the bathtub, and his manuscript is missing. You have the DC Madam, who has the list of all of the clients who are obviously using her service there in the Washington area, which Wayne Madsen and others said included as people like Vice President Dick Cheney. She says she's got these. She says she's never going to kill herself, and that she'll release the information if they send her to jail. They try to send her to jail, and she ends up hanging herself in the exact way she said she would never do. You have David Kelly, who was the weapons inspector there for the UN, who knew about the Iraq weapons of mass destruction lies and tried to blow the whistle to the BBC, ended up getting outed, said there were dark actors playing games and he'd be found dead in the woods, and shortly thereafter he was found dead in the woods. Again, we can go on and on and on and on about this, but it's just so blatant, and it's such a pattern that, again, anyone who's not willing to look into this is just willfully blind. And I don't know how this was done. I think you're right. The engine block flying 100 yards away from the fiery wreck is just ridiculous, but however it was accomplished, and there's all sorts of technical ways that they can tamper with people now in the age of computing systems in the cars, it's probably easier than ever. But however it was done, I think it behooves us all to look into this. I mean, we really have to spend a little bit of time becoming familiar with the history of how this has been done in the past, so that we will not let it happen again in the future. And as someone who's myself, I'm trying to bring some of this information to light. If I ever end up in one of these flaming fiery wrecks, or if I ever end up with a heroin needle sticking out of my arm and a dead hooker in some, you know, hotel or something, I hope people will question it. I ask people to question it, and please look into it. But don't accept the first version of events that they come out and report on it, because it's almost certainly going to be a lie.
We often say that, but I don't know if it will help. You know, we've seen a lot of our friends get cancered or have accidents. We talked about a few of those last week. I mean, you just look at Paul Wellstone, and you mentioned the DC Madam. You look at anybody connected to the JFK assassination. I'm just reading H.P. Abarelli's newest book on the JFK, stuff that even I didn't know, that has to do with narcotics in Houston. That's a Bush town, Bushville for people if you don't know that. And, you know, eliminating police officers that are reporting on drugs, that's always the thing. Look, I suppose that people can look at something like this. Here's a reporter that really had the tiger by the tail, and all of a sudden he's dead. And as I mentioned last week, that seems pretty obvious to me. I actually got an angry letter about that. My voice is too loud, and no, not everybody sees this as a potential problem or a little bit fishy. I didn't say everyone. Only 90% of the people, James, see those things. 10% really pretty much see whatever the government and the media tell them to. The rest of us can be a little suspicious, 50% at least, if I want to go that far, know that this is bad news, that this is no good, no bueno, that there's a problem here. Look, all they had to do was tell this guy, you got a source. He's going to meet you in 5 minutes. If you're not there, he's gone. And that guy's flying through the city to meet his source, and that's when the remote control bomb goes off. You know? I mean, it's not that hard to do in this day and age with the technology. For all we know, you know, there was some new weapon we've never even heard of used before. In the case of Paul Wellstone, I thought we, you know, looked at some kind of, I don't know, what do you call it, pulse beam shot that shut down the electronics of that plane. Here's a guy in Senator Wellstone of Minnesota who is going to fight tooth and nail against the Patriot Act. Maybe one of the only people that were going to do that with any clout. And he's sitting on the committees. Here's a guy with a big voice. It's not Ron Paul we're talking about here. They couldn't have him in the way. And then John Kerry's wife was married to Senator John Hines, and he was a skull and bonesman as well. Well, John Kerry now has the Hines fortune in his back pocket, and he's Secretary of State. The John Tower plane going down. Just again, there's so many of these. After a while, we've got to just call them as we see them. And why else are we here? We're not here just to repeat what the mainstream media is saying. Why else would we be here, James, in cyberspace or wherever we exist, other than to report the other side of the story that's not being reported?
That's exactly it. I mean, that's why I'm here. In fact, I've often thought to myself, you know, if they would even just bring up some of this information, if they'd even just talk about some of this information in the so-called mainstream news, I might never have woken up to this. I might have thought, well, you know, they're covering it, they're talking about it. It was when I consistently saw them not talking about these incredibly big issues that I knew that there was something majorly up. And when I started to research it, sure enough, I found,
Let me say this. You know what else turns up? And you can go on this one. What else turns up in the Michael Hastings case? Apparently, he was talking to WikiLeaks before his death.
Yeah, exactly. They've got their nose into everything all of a sudden. In fact, I think it was the New York Times just ran a story saying WikiLeaks is now back on the scene as they're back in the heart of things, the thick of things with the Snowden case. So, again, make of that what you will. And Ecuador now raising its head with the asylum and all of this. Again, I don't really know what to make of this, and I think we'll have to continue to watch how that unfolds. But anyway, yeah, no, I mean, it stinks to high heaven at the very least. And again, I mean, people who want to willfully ignore all of this can certainly stick their head back in the sand. I don't feel the need to convince anyone of anything that I'm thinking or believing, but I'm just here trying to put some of the facts on the table. And the fact is, Hastings was one of those thorns in the side of the establishment, and he was saying to people he had to go off the radar. He was working on something, and he said he was being investigated by the FBI, and he ends up dead 15 hours later. So you do the math.
Exactly. 1 + 1 = 16. So I've done the math. The media told me it was 16. The media told me 1 + 1 = 11. So that's what I'm going to believe. James Corbett with us, thecorbettreport.com, corbettreport.com, where he does daily podcasts, and you can't miss this stuff. The guy just really does his homework and has great guests, as you know. A lot of my listeners are fans of yours. Where do you want to go now? Because we've got two things on the docket before I get you out of here in about 12 minutes. One is ramping up of Syria, rebels pledging loyalty to Al-Qaeda today. That's in the news. Troop movements suggesting an invasion of Syria. The red line, the little bit of chemical weapons that were allegedly used that there's no proof was actually used by Assad against his people. He gassed his own people. That worked with Saddam Hussein. Why not try that again? And everything else under the sun, Syria. Let's hit that, and then we'll end up on revolution. Maybe that will give us kind of a good note to end on. Are you following the progression of violence escalating in Syria?
I am. In fact, I just had Michel Chosadovsky from globalresearch.ca on the program, and I interviewed him about a week ago, and at that time, he was basically coming forward with the thesis that basically the terrorist rebels had been put down. They'd basically been squashed. And then what happens? But of course, the U.S. raises the chemical weapons line yet again to try to shift the momentum. And here we are now once again on the brink. And I mean, I've been following this now for 2 years, and every single time it's the exact same thing. They make some kind of crazy accusation. It stirs things up. There's reports of troop movements. Everybody gets stirred up, and eventually it sort of simmers back down, and then it flares up again. It does seem that if the strategy is to keep that country and the region generally destabilized and in a state of flux, then they are successful, because obviously this has worked for 2 years now. They are drawing Hezbollah and Iran into Syria to try to defend the Assad government, which is It's just basically creating a big mess there, which is convenient for them, and I don't know if they need to mop that mess up anytime in the near future. They can just keep funneling funds and arms into it indefinitely to just make sure that that country is basically taken off the geopolitical map altogether. So I'm not necessarily convinced they are even looking for an endgame other than simply to keep the region destabilized at this point.
Yeah, what it looked like when they first rose this issue of chemical weapons being used in Syria, when that first came up, and a lot of people were on Obama as if he's really making any of these decisions. Folks, please think about that carefully. He's not, but let's just say that the people believe he is. And he said, well, you know, I don't know. It's not really been proven. And I don't know if they've crossed the red line yet. We're looking into it. And he got criticized by McCain, who went out on Memorial Day of all times to have kind of an NDAA meeting with Al-Qaeda in Syria. If that's not, you know, hypocrisy, I don't know what is. But I thought the first thing was kind of a warning. All right, if we want to, we can use this against you. So now, Assad, do what we tell you and leave all your money behind. We'll even let you get out a back door, maybe. You know how they make these deals. And because it was, I think, at the time, and they're believing it could have been a little tough negotiating with Russia on this. They've stood back and let us bomb everybody in the past, but maybe this time it's a little too close for comfort. This is, you know, maybe the center of the earth, as some have said. So they didn't follow that warning, and now the second warning comes with troops amassing in Jordan, with threats of a no-fly zone, with lots of military movements going on in that area. It just seems to me like this thing can't go on much longer.
You know, the way you describe those shady dealings and background conversations, it sounds like the plot to a mafia gangster movie. And I couldn't disagree with that assessment.
No. I do have Whitey Bulger, the Whitey Bulger trial. That's also on our website today, deadlinelive.info. We are going to hear some of the deep, dark secrets of the FBI. Don't count on it, folks. We probably won't hear that. But that's what's on the table as Whitey Bulger, the famous Boston, Massachusetts mob guy who's been on the run for 20 or 30 years, was a double agent. He was working for the FBI. So, maybe we'll learn something on that. But yeah, okay, it does sound like a script. Where do you think they get this? Now, I always ask the question, James, we could ask you, does art imitate life or life imitate art? So there you go.
It's a circle. It feeds on itself, and each one feeds into the other. And in fact, that's in a whole other field of research. I mean, there's some people doing some great work out there on that, like Tom Secker there in the UK, who's been examining spies and spy fiction and how the line between the two blurs, and how a lot of the spy fiction authors are themselves, you know, MI5 agents and things like this. I mean, it's absolutely fascinating to look at the way that cultural programming is used by the intelligence agencies and governments to move things along, and then they use some of those ideas for themselves. I mean, hijacking planes and flying them into the World Trade Center was a common theme in fiction before it actually happened. So again, are they stealing the lines from the writers, or are the writers stealing the lines from what they hear from the intelligence agencies, or who knows? But it's fascinating to look at some of
1984, Brave New World, Philip Dick. A lot of these guys had access to intelligence. So it is warnings, because people won't read Anthony Sutton or something. They've got to put it in a movie, and that way people will absorb it, and it will at least get into their subconscious. I think the logical place to go from Syria is over to Turkey. Now, here's hypocrisy, right? Big time. They want to go in and help the poor citizens of Syria fight their evil leader. All they're doing is, it's just democracy. They're just rising up and trying to take an active role in their government and stop their fascist totalitarian government from ruling over them and making their lives miserable. But when the people of Turkey do that against Erdogan, it's not so good.
Oh, yeah, of course. Exactly. Because Erdogan's, a faithful in the back pocket kind of guy. So it's not going to be the pressing political issue that some of the other revolutions are. I mean, it's always interesting to see what revolutions and what protests get airplay and what don't. And what's happening in Turkey? I want to take the big picture of this, because it's not just Turkey. It's obviously what we're seeing in Brazil now, with millions of people spilling out onto the streets there across the country. I just want to contrast what's going on in these countries for the different reasons that they're taking place in the different contexts. I understand that. But just seeing the getting together of millions of people who have just completely had enough and are spilling onto the streets and just not going to take no for an answer, that is something that I would hope that people in the U.S. and here in Japan, where I am, and in Canada and everywhere else around the world would take a look at and hopefully get a pointer or two. I'm not one of these people who thinks that that marching on Washington is going to be the solution to our problems. But at the end of the day, I really do think that at the very least, we have to be outraged about what's going on, and we have to demonstrate that. And if we do not get out there on the streets and start doing something about these outrages, they will just continue to happen. And no matter how much we document them, they will continue to happen. So I really hope that people will see what's going on around the world and at least understand it can be done. And looking at some of the pictures coming out specifically from Brazil, seeing just hundreds of thousands of people on the streets, it is a powerful thing to behold. And I look forward to the day that I start seeing that kind of protest happening in some of our, you know, cherished Western democracies.
All right. Well, Erdogan is a good public servant, or he's a good servant of the New World Order, but so was Mubarak. So was Hussein. So were the Taliban.
Yeah. In and out of favor, you know, people fall out of favor sometimes.
As I heard Michael Haas from the Council on Foreign Relations coming out and taking the side of the protesters. So it sounds to me like this is regime change for whatever reason. And the Turkish government, Erdogan, these guys are pretty tough to deal with. They have you really have to give them a lot before they give you anything. They're expert negotiators, and thus they're still controlling the oil fields of northern Iraq, you know, for whatever reason. So they don't like giving us no flies or a fly zone so we can fly through their territory without getting something in return. And I think they pissed somebody off. And this looks like not a spontaneous revolution, but kind of a George Soros Open Society Institute color revolution. Not that the people themselves aren't genuinely marching against, you know, real totalitarian government, but we saw what happened with Operation Ajax in 1953 in Iran. They go in with suitcases full of money. You start paying protesters to get out on the street, and then everybody else goes, hey, there's people on the dance floor. Let's go dancing.
Well, that's it. I mean, regardless of how these are manipulated to start, at the very least, the people who are participating in them are, for the most part, are genuinely pissed off at what's happening in their countries. And that outrage is something that's there that can be tapped into and, of course, can be sort of exploited and used as is needed for to accomplish whatever kind of regime changes in order. So I think the answer to that is, well, why don't we start it on our own terms rather than waiting for it to be approved by, you know, the Soros and all of the, you know, the groups that are behind us.
To some extent, we did that with the Tea Party, at least in 2007, when it got its origins, not when it was announced on TV. But both of those completely taken over, and they're now front.
Absolutely. And, you know, I've always, it's just flabbergasted me to see the Tea Party coming along and being completely ridiculed and made fun of and demonized by the left, and then Occupy coming along and being completely ridiculed and demonized and made fun of by the right, and no one understanding that those two movements, if they were able to come together, really are the basis for the next American Revolution. That is the revolution that needs to take place. People on those two sides of that fake imaginary line realizing they are actually advocating the same thing at base before it gets spun away, before it gets into the party politics, before the party lines are drawn. Those people were coming from the same basis, the same core root. The beginnings of the Tea Party was all about ending the Fed, and the beginnings of Occupy was obviously all about trying to get rid of the Wall Street finance manipulators. It's the same thing at base, if only they could see it. And that's one of the, I think, the main goals that the alt media should be
taken over. And Van Jones had to, you know, use wedge issues like abortion or global warming or racism to keep the two divided, because in the end they were starting to get together, which is why I registered OCCUT.org, because I was hoping that we could push that snowball down the hill, as I like to say. And we'll end on Brazil. James Corbett has been our guest. He's a once-a-month guest. In fact, I'm doing your show tomorrow, and I really am honored to be on your show every time. CorbettReport.com, that's linked at jackblood.com. But let's go ahead and finish up quickly here with Brazil. You know, one of the things I did predict at the end of last year is that we'd have an American spring, and it would start in Central and South America. I'd also predicted that we would lose Venezuela, that Venezuela would have the turmoil that they've had, that their leader would die. And not that I, you know, have a crystal ball, but a lot of this just seemed like writing on the wall that it should have happened last year, but there was an election and, you know, it's very complicated. So Am I seeing what I'm seeing with Brazil? Because they did detach themselves somewhat from the IMF and the World Bank. They were coming back. And I can't see that the people would be so upset about bus fare or the price of a football game, though in a way it does kind of make sense. But I can't really see that that's going to put millions of people out on the street. They can't be that dissatisfied from where they were 10 years ago. Does this look to you like a David Rockefeller free trade area of the Americas move to consolidate the entire Western Hemisphere into an American Union? That these guys weren't playing ball. They weren't doing what they were told. Again, they were bad leaders and bad dictators for the most part. And that this has been somehow put up to get them under control. Now that, I guess, could sound like a conspiracy theory, but what do you think is going on in Brazil? Is this got teeth?
I'm going to do a 180 on you on this one. I think that this one is more likely to be genuine than the one in Turkey and in its roots because of the history of what's been going on there in Brazil for the last decade. And they've been talking about this recovery and everything's A-okay, but the statistics have been manipulated by the World Bank. And in fact, this rhetoric about, oh, it's the Workers' Party and they're populist, they're progressive, they've been, you know, fighting the IMF, it isn't really true when you start to look at it. There's an excellent article up on Global Research by Professor Chossidovsky right now, Historical Roots of the Social Crisis in Brazil, the Role of the IMF, where he talks about how the Workers' Party has for the last decade been in the back pocket of the IMF and have had Wall Street, henchmen basically there in the roots advising them on this. And in fact, the IMF even commended Rousseff's predecessor there, President Da Silva, by saying he was, it was a remarkable social transformation in Brazil is being underpinned by macroeconomic stability and rising living standards. The IMF has been singing the praises of this government for a decade. And
that's the same thing. But that's the same thing. And so I appreciate where you're coming from. Again, we're kind of back to what organically starts these uprisings. Because the reason I have to be suspicious is that we have Joseph Stiglitz's World Bank documents and IMF documents that talk about, growing inflation on purpose to grab the resources of this whatever country they're targeting or whatever region or geographical area they're targeting, and then they use riots to try to get to where they're going here. I mean, this right out of their playbook.
But the IMF riot is the hyperinflationary riot that comes with the privatization. But this is kind of the opposite of what's been happening in Brazil right now. I I hope people will go and read through the Chossidovsky article because he lays it out quite well, and he's been studying it longer than I have. But I'm going to disagree with you on this one. I think that they've basically been in the back pocket. I think that the Brazil resistance is a genuine resistance of the people against the IMF agenda as they see it unfolding. I think they're basically in an austerity type of situation that's being forced on them by a government that was supposed to be 180 degrees opposed to that. So I think this one is genuine. I can be proven wrong.
Who benefits? There shouldn't be a Brazil. We know that the free trade area of the Americas, David Rockefeller's, final bucket list moment, and he can't go on much longer here. That's what he's been working with all these years. If there is no Brazil or there is no Argentina, which I think could be next here, there is no Venezuela, that all of that is a country in name only, and that their extended CAFTA extends down to the free trade area of the Americas, we do become the American Union at that point. So if there's instability in Brazil, if Brazil goes down, if sovereignty becomes more of an illusion like it is in Europe, then we've got our trade zone here. We've got our American Union. And if that's the end game, we could both be right. But when people disagree with me on the show, James Corbett, I generally just get rid of them. So bye. You got to go now.
Well, actually, I was going to give you that point. I think you're right. And I think you're right. Argentina might be next to fall because of what's going on there. So, we'll see how it plays out. We'll talk about it again. And you will be on my program tomorrow night. So I'm looking forward to that. And I have a homework assignment for you because I'm concentrating on positivity this week, despite all the horrible stuff, or maybe because of all the horrible stuff that's happening. I want to find out from some of the people out there in the media, what do you think is a positive thing that's happening out there? Something that gives you hope for the future. So you put on your thinking cap and we'll discuss it in about 36 hours.
I could, that's right down my pocket. I do that every day. We try to focus on the battles we are winning. I do a whole show like that, but no one would listen, James.
Yeah, I hear you.
Anger and fear And so I've got to give it to him every once in a while. But, you know, don't be afraid and don't be angry. We just got to know what's going on. And the best way to do that is to go to the Corbett Report, CorbettReport.com. And please donate, because he runs like this show, no commercials. It is completely listener sponsored, and that is the honor system. So please donate to the Corbett Report when you can. Keep that going. It's a fine, fine anti-institution, and it's not programming. It's deprogramming, much like our show, The Jack Blood Show. We'll be right back after this. Thank you, James. Appreciate it. Second hour coming up.